Thanks for downloading Rear Vision. And if you find the story of Tunisia's evolution from dictatorship to democracy interesting, there's more. Tunisia before the revolution. You'll find it at abc.net.au/radionational/programs/rearvision. Hello, thanks for joining me for Rear Vision. I'm Keri Phillips, here today with a good news story from the Arab Spring.
A state of emergency has been declared in Tunisia after some of the worst riots in two decades have left at least 23 people dead.
Food and fuel prices are rising and unemployment is close to 14%, even higher for the country's educated youth.
All the people are gathered here to say to Ben Ali, leave us alone, that's all.
We are not satisfied with jobs. We need dignity, freedom, liberty, okay?
The popular uprisings that became known as the Arab Spring were launched by a single event in Tunisia in December 2010. The self-immolation of a 26-year-old fruit seller over a dispute with local authorities tapped into anger over rising prices and unemployment, government corruption and repression to fuel widespread street protests that forced President Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali to flee the country. Today, as the people of Tunisia vote for a new president, Rear Vision asks how Tunisia, alone of all the Arab Spring countries, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Syria and so on, has managed to stay on the path to democracy.
After 24 years in power, the Tunisian president has fled the country after failing to stop an uprising against his iron-fisted regime.
In the Tunisian capital, protesters demand the resignation of the man who's run their country for 24 years.
You have killed your people. Leave immediately. We have had enough of promises, enough of lies.
As night fell, the country's prime minister went on television to announce that he was assuming power.
I do think people were absolutely elated when Ben Ali fled the country and left to Saudi Arabia on January 14th, 2011. The country was ecstatic.
Monica Marx is researching Tunisia's Islamist party, Ennahda, for her doctoral studies at Oxford University. I spoke to her by Skype.
Ben Ali's departure, however, did not mean that the RCD, his party, melted away entirely, or that his old corrupt cronies went into their hiding places and stayed there. There was an interim government that formed right after Ben Ali fled the country, led by a man named Mohamed Ghannouchi, who had been very close to Ben Ali and his regime. And there were a series of protests in March and April of 2011 called the Kasba protests, which aimed to push those remnant people out of government. And those protests were successful. But it took a series of protests in the spring after the revolution to really get a clean interim administration into power, which then began organizing for the country's first elections in October 2011.
By the time of those elections, Ben Ali's party had been banned and Ennahda, Tunisia's Islamist party, legalized. Tunisians went to the polls to elect an interim constituent assembly, one that would be charged with drafting a new constitution for the country.
Tunisia's Islamist party Ennahda has emerged as the big winner in the country's first free elections. But its vote wasn't big enough to let it govern in its own right, so a coalition is certain.
These elections have produced very much a diversity of political parties who will have to share power and work together to draft the new constitution so that it doesn't become a theocracy. They want it to be a democracy, not a theocracy.
Ennahda's victory in October 2011 really was amazing because the party had been all but entirely banned under Ben Ali. Since about 1990, 1991, the party had not only been outlawed as a supposed terrorist organization, but its members had been imprisoned. About 30,000 were arrested and imprisoned. Many of them were tortured. Many wives and sisters and mothers of people associated with Ennahda were sexually abused and harassed by the police. So the party wasn't able to hold any official meetings out in the open. Everything they did was either activity in exile, primarily in France, the United Kingdom, and Italy, or it was clandestine here in Tunisia.
Alexander Martin is a doctoral student in the School of Government and International Affairs at Durham University.
What was significant was that the Ennahda party were very organised. I mean, they had been in exile in London for the last sort of 20 years, and they knew how to operate as a political entity. At the time, if you look at the other parties that are in existence, they were sort of very disorganised. It wasn't very clear what they stood for, whereas it was obvious that Ennahda were a form of moderate Islam that appealed to a lot of people. And the way that the voting system happened as well, it was only party names and logos displayed. It was a closed list proportional representation system. So on the ballot paper, you could only see the logo of the party, and most people didn't know who the other parties were. So Ennahda was the one that sort of stood out. And the way they did their campaigning was very different as well. They went around doing door-to-door work, kind of grassroots campaigning that the other parties weren't even doing.
How did Ennahda manage government? Did they fulfil people's expectations? Asma Ghribi is a Tunisian journalist.
I think their performance, you know, when they were in government was not great. I mean, like, the situation in Tunisia was so difficult. I don't think any political party who would have gained power, like, would not be able to fix the problems in Tunisia, especially on a socio-economic level when it comes to unemployment and things like that. So the situation was too difficult to be fixed in 1 or 2 years. Plus, they don't have any experience in government. They were, you know, for example, the prime minister is someone who spent 20 years in jail, and then he was out for like 5 years. I don't know what he was doing. And most of his ministers as well. So like both prime ministers that we have, they don't have any experience in government, and they spent most of their lives in jail. So, of course, how can they fix the big economic problems, big social and security problems, if you don't have any experience in government? So that was, I feel, one of their biggest challenges.
Chokri Belaid was shot at close range as he left home for work. The gunman fled on a motorcycle. Within hours, crowds in several cities were battling police, hurling rocks amid volleys of tear gas.
Mohamed Brahimi, an outspoken critic of the Islamist-led ruling coalition, was gunned down outside of his home. It's just months after the assassination of another politician, the leftist Popular Front leader, Chokri Belaid.
The president, Moncef Marzouki, has condemned the killing.
The criminals know that we are in the last minutes of our transformation to a democracy. The constitution is almost finished. Elections are around the corner. Their goals are known: destabilizing the country, intimidating the people, and painting us as a failed state.
Those were, to a large extent, you know, a clear and a very dramatic, sad, certainly, expression of the big political deadlock that the country was reaching.
Ayman Ayoub is Regional Director of the West Asia and North Africa Program at the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, an intergovernmental organization.
It's unfortunate that only with that all political forces understood that they were reaching a dangerous point in the process, and that certainly consensus was very much needed. As I'm saying, you know, sadly so, with those two big losses of prominent figures in the political sphere here in Tunisia, everybody understood that they certainly had to sit on one table and work out a success story of this process. And that's indeed what happened. As you know, a very important national dialogue process driven by what was called the quartet here by the General Workers' Union of the country, accompanied by, you know, the Union of Commerce Chambers and the Bar Association and the Tunisian League for Human Rights, who all were organizations with a long history behind, you know, a big reputation, well accepted by all actors. And they managed to drive a very difficult, really, national dialogue process. Obviously, those two assassinations were, say, a determinant factor, you know, to trigger that. I think that the assassinations happened at a point where the different political views, or the two sides of the two main sides, let's say, of the political, you know, struggle in the country, both maybe thought that they could force more the others to accept their position.
Tunisia's Constituent Assembly has approved a new constitution, the first since the uprising 3 years ago that helped to spark the Arab Spring.
There was a sense of joy, pride and relief here when it became clear that the new constitution had been adopted with an overwhelming majority. If put into practice, clauses such as Article 45 are bound to make history. The clause requires half the candidates for all electoral lists to be female. The governing Islamist Ennahda party made some concessions. Most importantly, the removal of references to Islamic law to get the text passed.
If you look at other countries throughout the world that have gone from dictatorship to a functioning liberal democracy, writing a constitution often does take at least 2 to 3 years. So Tunisia aren't that much of an exception. And the important thing they were doing was they were taking the process slowly and debating issues one at a time, rather than rushing through a process like Egypt did, where it tried to force through a constitution that was unacceptable to large percentages of the population. What Tunisia got right was the theme of consensus. They wanted to make sure that this was a constitution that the vast majority of the MPs in the country were happy with. I mean, of course, there are still some people that were not happy with it, but eventually when it was passed, 200 out of 217 voted in favour of it. So that was a huge achievement. And it was a case of the Islamist party, Ennahda, making compromises on one side and other groups sort of also making compromises. So that's why it was such a slow process.
What were the really critical issues that had to be resolved?
Initially there were issues about whether Islam would be mentioned in the constitution or whether it wouldn't. So Islam is mentioned in the preamble of the constitution, but there are no references to Sharia law in the constitution, which is something that the Ennahda party conceded on. There was also a controversial article about the status of women, which civil society groups and women's groups and human rights groups all reacted vehemently to, and then that was changed. Those were the two major things, Islam and women's rights.
Well, Tunisia has been at the forefront of Arab countries in terms of protecting the role of women. In 1956, the first post-colonial president, a man named Habib Bourguiba, instituted the personal status code, which made polygamy illegal, which gave women the right to divorce. These are rights that women really don't have anywhere else in the Arab world, and Tunisians are extremely proud of these rights. Even many Islamists look at this personal status code of 1956 as something very specific about Tunisia that's very praiseworthy and that needs to be preserved. After the revolution, a constituent assembly was elected in October 2011, which started making drafts of the new constitution, a constitution people hoped would be democratically representative and give the country a fresh start. The constitution went through four successive drafts. In the first draft, there was language that said, "Yatakamul darhuma fil usra." And the translation of this from the Arabic means, "Their two roles." In other words, men and women's two roles complement, the word could also be translated as complete, one another inside the family. Now, this passage was widely mistranslated in French and English media as saying women are men's complements. That's not what it said. It said women and men's roles complete each other within the family. But this was still ambiguous language that could be very subject to misinterpretation, and many people, many civil society activists, feminists, etc., said this had no place in the constitution, and it was taken out by the second draft. So this language was put forward in August of 2012, but it was taken out within just a couple of months. The ultimate final draft of the constitution, which was passed in January of this year, had no such language and preserves the 1956 personal status code and even goes farther, saying that the country has the obligation to make sure women are equally represented in politics.
You're listening to Rear Vision on RN, by mobile on the ABC Radio app, and by podcast. I'm Keri Phillips, here today with a program looking at Tunisia's remarkable, if fragile, progress on the path from dictatorship to democracy. Asma Ghribi says that Ennahda initially dug in their heels over the constitution because they'd drawn the wrong conclusions from their success in the interim elections.
I thought people voted for them because they wanted a change, because they wanted more conservative laws in Tunisia or something like that. So that's why they had those several attempts to include like the Sharia in the constitution or to include some more Islamist ideology in the constitution. I interviewed so many people about this, and so many people would say we voted for them because they said they were religious, so we thought they're pious, and we thought they would implement social justice and would improve our situation and give us jobs. So people voted for them because they wanted to improve their economic situation and not because they wanted Sharia or whatsoever. So too bad for Islamists. They wasted a lot of time discussing those things within the National Constituent Assembly. And that's what made people just grow sick of the whole political process and not vote for them again.
And when the first elections for the new Assembly of the Representatives of the People were held last month, Ennahda was punished at the polls.
Vote counting is underway in Tunisia in the first parliamentary election in the country since the overthrow of its long-time ruler 3 years ago. Preliminary results showed that the leading Tunisian secular party has taken the lead, winning more than 80 seats in the new 217-member parliament.
The birthplace of the Arab Spring has been hailed as a regional success story. While other nations who followed Tunisia's uprising have seen more bloodshed, it's seen as an example of political compromise between secular and Islamist movements.
Tunisia's leading secular party, Nida Tunis, won 85 seats in the new parliament, the Islamist party 69. Nida Tunis will need the support of smaller parties, though, to form government.
I would say the easiest reading of this would be that obviously whoever was in government during this difficult transitional 3 years almost would suffer, you know, from that, because the challenges are paramount and the expectations are very high, and therefore nobody is able to like have a magic stick in their hands to find a solution immediately to all the difficulties. So it's a natural, in a way, a natural, you know, a result of them being in government for most of that period to lose some popular support. There are also other elements, of course. You know, what has happened across the region, I think, has to a good extent its reflections also in here. You know, the sad experiences that we can see, you know, of radical Islam in some countries, and what's happening in other countries, but also in their immediate neighbor in Libya, I think has its reflections here, and people somehow, like, you know, have stopped to think a bit more. What everybody sees as a much more moderate, you know, political Islam in Tunisia than any other country in the region, you know, our type of political Islam has always been much more moderate in that sense. The emergence also, you know, of Nida Tunis, who is the winner of these last elections on 26 October 2014, you know, the leader of this political party, Bajikait Sepsi, is a very historical figure in the country. And although he was associated to the Ben Ali regime to a certain extent, he actually, or his career, originates from the times of Bourguiba, who is the national hero for the Tunisians. And I think with that he managed to bring together many of the second line politicians throughout the recent history of Tunisia, who are quite accepted by a large majority of Tunisians, you know.
The question of what comprises Nidat Tunis and what Nidat Tunis's legislative win means for the country, these are very important questions. And they're questions Western researchers and journalists have largely failed to ask, because we've had a tendency to hold the magnifying glass of critical inquiry up to Islamists more than secularists, because there's an assumption that Islamists inherently threaten democratic pluralism, but secularists don't. And Tunisia problematizes those assumptions. Nidat Tunis is far less internally democratic than Ennahda. The party has no elected internal mechanisms whatsoever, no elected internal bodies. It functions as a top-down paternalistic pyramid in which its leader, 87-year-old Bajikait Sepsi, who will be 88 next week, makes all major decisions. Many people inside the executive bureau of Nidat Tunis recognize that he's the glue holding the party together. This party formed in June 2012 as an opposition front to Ennahda. The main trends in the party are leftists and members of the old regime. The party tries to portray itself as a broad coalition of leftists, trade unionists, business people, and what they call Destorians. They're hearkening back to the Destorian or constitutional party of Habib Bourguiba, who was president before Ben Ali. They're trying to say, we're not really affiliated with Ben Ali. He was a thug. We're hearkening back to Bourguiba, to this kind of enlightened autocratic rule. But actually inside the party, there are a great many people who were affiliated with Ben Ali's party, the RCD. And it's widely acknowledged, even by people in the executive committee of Nidet Tunis, that one of the reasons they were able to get so much success and form such a broad network across the country so quickly was that much of their funding came from RCD business people, and much of their local outreach relied on the reactivation of old RCD networks.
The leader of Nidet Tunis, Beji Caid Essebsi, is among the field of 27 candidates for today's presidential election and widely considered the frontrunner.
It's very possible that Nidet Tunis's legislative win last month, paired with Beji Caid Essebsi's presidential win this Sunday, could represent a kind of soft restoration of the old regime. It's very important to ask, if Nidet Tunis has control of the parliament, if they have the presidency, and if they appoint a prime minister who's very friendly, what sorts of checks and balances will this new constitution be able to put on their rule? And the answer is not so many, actually. Because new constitutions in politically transitioning countries tend to be very fragile pieces of paper unless there's real institutional reform and real mechanisms through which the constitution can be enforced. Now, Tunisia's new constitution, which was passed in January of this year, relies on a constitutional court for enforcement. And this constitutional court is appointed one-third by the president, one-third by the prime ministry, and one-third by the parliament. So if Nidet Tunis has control, either outright control or soft control, of all three of those mechanisms, it's very questionable the extent to which real checks and balances will be put on their power. It's also worth noting that Tunisia is an old police state, and as in most police states, the Ministry of Judiciary and the Interior Ministry, which controlled the police, tend to be the most corrupt, corroded, unreformed ministries. That's certainly the case here in Tunisia. So it's very possible that a party comprised so heavily of old regime figures could kind of reach behind its back and tighten some of those judiciary and security sector screws and start re-implementing the sorts of old regime practices, particularly human rights abuses of Islamists and young secular revolutionaries. And this has raised some concern. Although, of course, we can't judge Nidet Tunis until it's in power, but it's important to raise these critical questions about checks and balances.
Despite such concerns about the future, Tunisia stands as a democratic beacon in a landscape littered with Arab Spring failures. The military has been restored to power in Egypt, Libya is virtually a failed state, and Syria has been ripped apart by civil war.
Well, there's lots of reasons why Tunisia has been a success. One of the main ones might just be something as simple as geography. It's a very small country with only 10 million people. And then if you look at the demographics of the country, it's 99% Sunni Muslim. If you look at a country like Libya, there's lots of tribal differences and tribal allegiances which don't exist in Tunisia. One of them I see as important is the way that the military in Tunisia plays almost no role whatsoever in politics. If you look at the military in Egypt, they play a huge role. The Tunisian military has always stayed out of politics, so there isn't that faction of the population that has this vested interest in what happens in the political arena. And also significantly, Ben Ali left. He didn't put up a fight. He got on that plane and never came back from Saudi Arabia.
I feel Tunisia has always been kind of an exception in the whole region. And it has so many factors that help this experience, and they will probably strengthen it even in the future, hopefully. I mean, if we compare Tunisia to Egypt or to other countries, first of all, Tunisia is smaller. The middle class in Tunisia is bigger than other countries. Poverty rate is also lower in Tunisia. Of course, education and literacy rates are much more higher here, it's a homogenous society, so we don't really, like, it's not like Syria. It's not a problem, but unfortunately it proved that, you know, diversity in this part of the world is like, it doesn't work. So good for Tunisia that it's more of a homogenous country. We don't have so many sects or religions. You know, even like the small minorities like Jews or Christians in Tunisia, they happen not to be very vocal when it comes to politics, and they're really like really small minority. Also in Tunisia we have a strong institutions, and that's probably what helped us avoid the Libyan scenario. Why not? It's just chaotic. Since the revolution we did not have one day of institutional void. The revolution happened on Friday, January 13th, and Monday people went back to work. Of course, you can feel there is more like some security issues because, you know, the revolution happened against the police and the police were kind of scared. But it was not really like a situation of like total chaos where you didn't know what to do. The institutions were working, it's like nothing happened.
What challenges lie ahead for Tunisia and its new government?
Well, I would say the first three big challenges, I would always put them under economy and economy and economy. This country has poor resources. It has important levels of unemployment. A big percentage of the population are young people, most of them university graduated without proper employment or without employment at all. So I would say that the biggest challenge would be the economy of the country and the improvement of the conditions in the daily lives of the people here. This morning, coming to this interview, actually, I was a bit late because of a strike in public transport, actually, in Tunisia, which, by the way, I see as a good democratic practice, you know. And maybe the second big challenge would be to continue driving with success the ongoing national dialogue process that is not concluded, of course, and that now we'll have to move into implementing the constitution and therefore building all the democratic institutions that need to be built in the country, the legal framework that needs to be amended and looked at, etc. And finally, one important or additional challenge, I would say, is to make sure that they can continue to block the country, you know, from bigger influence of terrorist groups and jihadists, etc. And let's not forget that this is only a small country that is falling along the border of a country like Libya, where this is a major big challenge, of course, and also is bordering to Algeria, where these issues are still on the agenda.
I think there's reason for hope in Tunisia. Tunisians have achieved some very remarkable things. They completed this democratically representative constitution in January of this year. They've held two mostly free, fair, and peaceful elections. But there are some real challenges that remain regarding the economy, institutional reform, checks and balances in the new system that could truly jeopardize the future of this transition. So I think it's important to push back against this simplistic narrative that Tunisia is the model. Tunisia is the success story of an otherwise darkened region. No, political transitions take time. Tunisia will be battling between forces of authoritarianism and pluralism for a long time, and it's important to watch this closely.
Monica Marx, who's researching Tunisia's Islamist party, Ennahda, for her doctoral studies at Oxford University. On Rear Vision today, you also heard Asma Ghribi, a Tunisian journalist, Alexander Martin from Durham University, and Ayman Ayoub from the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. Judy Rapley is the sound engineer for Rear Vision today. Bye from Keri Phillips.